I'd like to thank the organizers of the conference for inviting me here, this wonderful place. Actually, while I was listening to talks of other speakers, I was wondering, should this really be considered the loopy stage of quantum gravity? Okay, I'll be talking about effective constraints in loop quantum gravity, or more precisely, how we can use the ideas that Martin was talking about in the morning to make some predictions in the framework of loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology. So this work was done together with Martin, Ghulam Hossein from Penn State, and Hector Hernandez and Aureliano Skirzewski from Albert Einstein Institute. And in the beginning of this project, Ra was also helping us. So after a brief motivation, I'll summarize the ideas that Martin presented in the morning, and then I'll focus on two things. The anomaly issue, which may arise when one is dealing with effective constraints. And then I'll tell you briefly how one can construct effective constraint in some particular example in loop quantum cosmology. Okay, so it's promising to study cosmological inhomogeneities for thoroughly. First, we can test semi-classical limit of loop quantum gravity. The evolution of inhomogeneities is expected to explain cosmological structure formation, and in principle can lead to some observable predictions, observable on the cosmic microwave background. And also, the effective approximation that we have used is very convenient in the sense that it allows to extract predictions of the quantum theory without actually constructing quantum states and dealing with quantum operators much. Okay, so here is the summary of the effective approximation. So we start with classical theory, which is formulated in terms of classical constraints and classical Poisson brackets. Upon quantization, we promote the constraint operators with some commutation relations. Then in the effective theory, there is an infinite set of quantum variables, which are basically various moments of quantum operators on some appropriate states. That is, expectation values, spreads, deformations, and so on. So we'll be only focusing on expectation values, assuming that the other moments are not significant. So this is so-called truncation procedure. And for the expectation values, we can have two situations. If these expectation values are of operators which correspond to classically well-behaved expressions, then the expectation values of such operators are just classical expressions. What's more interesting is when we consider operators which correspond to classically diverging expressions. Then some correction functions arise, and that's what we'll be studying. Okay, to just summarize. Starting with classical constraint and the algebra, we get constraint operators and commutation relations. Then in the effective approximation, we obtain effective constraints, which are just classical expressions, but may contain correction terms. And they have some effective Poisson algebra. Now, the effective constraints give rise to effective equations of motion. So this was investigated in the context of quantum cosmology for some simple case of scalar mode and longitudinal gauge. So these are the papers on this issue. And another thing is that the effective Poisson algebra may be different from the classical Poisson algebra, and we may face anomaly issue when the algebra doesn't close. So I'll be talking about these two issues. I'll start with anomaly issue. We should check that, in principle, we have we can have correction, because if there are no corrections which would lead to anomaly-free algebra, we just shouldn't be even starting doing anything. So, study what conditions should hold to have an anomaly-free theory, and then I'll tell you how we can construct effective constraints. So, matter will be represented by a scalar field pi with its conjugate momentum pi, and the variables for gravity will be the densitized triad and afterpar connection, which is the sum of spin connection and extrinsic curvature, and gamma is the emergency parameter. So, in the effective approximation, diffeomorphism constraint, there are two constraints which we're dealing with, diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraint. Diffeomorphism constraint doesn't change. We assume that it still implements diffeomorphisms. And the Hamiltonian constraint consists of two constraints, the gravity part and the matter part. So, using our experience with homogeneous and isotropic models, we should expect effective corrections to arise whenever we have a classically divergent quantity. So they are sitting in three places here. So whenever we have an inverse determinant, it diverges classically. So we should expect some quantum corrections here. So note that in the homogeneous and isotropic case, only D correction is present, because this term is just absent in the homogeneous setting. And if we look at this term, it has a product of two triads and square root of determinant of triad. So in the homogeneous and isotropic case, this quantity is not diverging. But in the presence of an isotropy, this will diverge. And we should also consider this correction. These are the two constraints we have. Q stands for quantum modified, quantum corrected constraint. So we should just consider two Poisson brackets between H and D and between two H's. So H with D gives this expected result, Hamiltonian of another lapse, which is the linear derivative of this lapse along the shift vector. And this is the extra term. So we see that I skipped some terms like Hamiltonian density. So what's important is that we should require that each of these terms vanishes separately, because in principle we cannot have matter at all. So we should require that this term vanishes, and also by similar argument we should conclude that these two terms vanish separately. So we require this to vanish up to at least the second order. That's the order in perturbation theory which we are interested in. And H with H gives two parts. So it gives diffeomorphism constraint, its gravitational part. So it differs from the classical result by the factor of alpha squared. And similarly, we have a diffeomorphism constraint of matter, which again differs from the classical result by this factor of d sigma. So in order these two things to combine into one diffeomorphism constraint, so we want standard algebra, alpha squared has to be equal to d sigma. Well, I'm summarizing the conditions here. So this is what I just said. Alpha squared has to be equal to d sigma. And this is the partial differential equation. Okay, alpha, d, and sigma should be some arbitrary function of some specific combination of the triad component. And this is the partial differential equation, which should be satisfied up to, again, second order perturbation. Again, we solved this equation up to second order. We found this combination. So we know how alpha should depend on both diagonal and off-diagonal triad components. Now, the effective, when deriving the effective constraints, we'll only obtain the dependence on the diagonal components of the triad. So in principle, when it's also obtained for the off-diagonal dependence, that can be compared to the result of the previous slide. Okay, so basically I'm briefly presenting the result of the paper by Martin, Hernandez, myself, and Lance Krzyzewski. So, and Yeah, using lattice formulations similar to what Thomas and Christina was doing. So this is a cubic lattice. I, J, K are the three directions. V labels vertex. The spacing of the lattice is L naught. So E represents an edge, and S is a surface orthogonal to an edge. So, and all these lattices are labeled with quantum numbers, mu, which have to do with eigenvalues of the triangle. So the basic variables are, again, fluxes of the triads and holonomies of the extrinsic curvature. So we assume that field is essentially constant within one cell of the lattice. So integration just yields a factor of L naught squared, the area of the space, times the triad component. So BVI is the flux through the surface, which is orthogonal to the edge, which starts at vertex V in the direction I. Okay, so normally one starts with SU2 holonomies, which are half-ordered exponentials of the extrinsic curvature. But at the end of the day, when all internal indices are contracted, what remains is just various sines and cosines of the extrinsic curvature components, which can be expressed in terms of these exponentials, which can be considered as SU1 holonomies. So again, it's a holonomy of the extrinsic curvature along the edge, which starts at V in the positive I direction. So there can be also V minus I and so on. So the basic operators are the flux operator and the holonomy operator. So the flux operator is diagonal in the lattice state. So this is the eigenvalue. This plus one should not be present here. So it just yields multiplication by this factor. What the holonomy operator does, it shifts the label of the edge on which this holonomy is computed. So out of these basic operators, we can construct more interesting operators like Hamiltonian constraint operator. Let me just schematically show you how to do that. So the curvature term in the Hamiltonian can be schematically represented as dA plus AA. Now we expand it into extrinsic curvature and the spin connection. So when contracted with EE term, the cross term just goes away because of the symmetry. So in the previous slide we assumed that, so we already assumed that we only consider the diagonal components of the triad and extrinsic curvature. That's exactly what's longitudinal gauge of scalar modulus. So due to symmetry, this cross term drops out, and we can call this K, FK, and this gamma, these result respectively in HK and H gamma, the two parts of the Hamiltonian constraint. So this is just a function of triads, so it will be diagonal on the lattice state. So what's more interesting is this part. And also, in the background, the gamma is zero, so this is of higher order than this. So let's focus on this part. So these are just the sines and cosines which I promised. And the expression is symmetrized over all possible orientations of the quartets, IJK, and possible direction of the holonomies in positive or negative direction along each edge. So in the homogeneous and isotropic case, this term yields the known result. Also, there are some high curvature corrections. This term is nothing else but the inverse triad operator. So let me show you what it is. So inverse triad classically is written as this, which can be expressed using Simon's trick as a Poisson bracket of connection with the volume operator. So it's quantized according to this expression. And this B operator is nothing else but the operator corresponding to the diagonal component of the inverse triad. So it's quantized, again, using the single expression. And this operator tends to be diagonal on the lattice states. So and its eigenvalue is given by this expression. So if we now look at the classical expression for the inverse triad, we see that it's not quite the same as here. So we introduced this correction function alpha such that the quantum corrected inverse triad is alpha times classical value of the triad. So and this alpha is given by this expression. Here it's plotted. So it has a cusp at mu equal 1/2, and then it goes to 1 at infinity. So what's important in cosmological applications that Martin mentioned in the morning is that alpha prime is always negative, and alpha double prime is always positive in the interesting sector. So that's important because for any mu during the expansion of the universe, the corrections have the same sign. They add up. So they do not compensate each other. Now we can generalize. We can have quantum ambiguities. In order to quantize an expression like this, we can first multiply, we can play this trick. We can multiply and divide by the same quantity with arbitrary k, just has to be greater than 1. And then, knowing that the Poisson bracket of A with B some power R is this, we can represent this quantity as this bunch of Poisson brackets. Now, after quantization, when all these are expressed as commutators of holonomous and volume operators, we can similarly obtain the correction function. So basically, correction function alpha is normalized to 1 at infinity eigenvalue of the B operator. So it's plotted here for various values of R, starting with R equal 1/2, the highest peak, and the largest possible value of R2 corresponds to this curve. Okay. So for any value of R, we get the same classical limit. So this is quantum ambiguity. Now we can also generalize to to different J representations. When taking that trace, we can take it in an arbitrary J representation. That would yield this expression. So it's a sum. And that sum can be approximated for large J by this formula. And here, I'm just plotting alpha for different R's when J is equal to 10. So it gets smoother when R increases, but it has a cusp for every half integer value of mu. And mu tilde is mu divided by J. In this figure, I'm plotting alpha for R equal 1 for the two different values of J, 10, 20, and I'm also plotting this smooth curve, which is the formula in the box. So you see, it's quite a good approximation. So asymptotic alpha approaches 1. This is the subleading term. And what's important is that for small values of mu tilde, and R within the allowed range, alpha is well behaved, doesn't diverge. So there are no singularities in the effective theory. Okay, to summarize, the anomalies that arise during effective approximation can be checked order by order. We can just run on trivial solutions which lead to anomaly-free algebra. Also, these conditions, they restrict possible quantum ambiguities, which I just showed. And since there is a consistent set of constraints, which are first class, we can formulate cosmological equations in terms of a gauge invariant variable, which would not be possible if there were anomalies present. Thank you for your attention.